I think he's working out of Downey now on a proposal activity, but boy, undoubtedly one of the top people in the industry. Yeah, if you want to know anything about the structural capability of the industry, he'd be an excellent one to talk to.
I'm trying to do that, Ralph.
Incidentally, very well respected by the Huntsville people, the structural laboratories at Huntsville. Very well respected.
Did you have any dealings with the Huntsville people when you were at Mississippi?
Oh, yes, yes.
Who'd you deal with?
Mainly from the test side.
Feinberg and
that. Yeah, at Mississippi, Bill Grafton was down there initially. Mm-hmm. And then after T, he moved back to Huntsville. And set up under Bob Bush and Jack Walsh was set up. So our dealings with Huntsville were mostly the stage office and the test lab. So that'd be the Heinbergs, the Driscolls, and the Jim Pearson and Leon Ray out of the test lab. And then in the stage office, first it was Sam York and then Godfrey and then Colonel Hatt now. Yeah. And Jim Odom and Briggle, all those folks. So that was our main dealing out of Huntsville. Oh, occasionally with some of the laboratories on a key point, but we were more in support of the main engineering activity. Mm-hmm.
So they'd deal with here and then it'd come over to you?
Yeah, or we'd come up to support them on a specific issue on how you get something done in Mississippi and how effectively you can test something, that kind of stuff.
Is it hard to get people to leave California, yourself, for example, go to Mississippi, or you just did what your company wanted you to do? No, Huntsville had trouble getting people down there.
Mississippi suffered from a lot of bad publicity early, and I think unduly so. When I went there, I thought it was going to be hell on earth, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, all I heard about was the mosquitoes, the snakes, and the 60 inches of rain here. And it didn't really make any difference to me, but I went down and I was very pleasantly surprised by the place, and actually I thought the area was reasonably nice. Mm-hmm. It's certainly different in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. but we did have trouble getting some people down. And by and large, the people that went down and stayed there for a while gradually liked it better and better. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we've got some people who moved down and just as soon stay there, you know, as we're closing out the place now. But it wasn't easy. It was a very difficult job manning up the place.
Well, you're an urbanite and you have a wife. How did you survive there? Did you have to go into New Orleans often? Or
No.
Just
rusticated. I don't give you my philosophy of life, but it depends on you know, what's of importance to you. And I've lived all over the country. So I've lived on the three coasts that the United States has now, and I've lived in the Midwest. And I don't see a whole lot of difference from one place to the other. You know, weather's a little different, but family's still the same, which is really the main core of your existence. So we've enjoyed every one of them a little bit differently. And I'd go any place, you know, I don't really care. It's becoming a little more difficult now. My kids are a little older and that kind of stuff, but assuming those kind of things. But we enjoyed it down there. And
Well, for younger people, it's a wise idea to move around with the company because you gain a lot of experience, you get acquainted with a lot of people.
I'll bring in 5 or 10 guys that I've got back here that I brought back from Mississippi that are now in the engineering department. I'd ask them, you know, if they'd trade what they had down there for anything. You just can't gain the experience and the broadness as quickly any other place. Mm-hmm. You know, I really feel for some of the folks here who have worked in a design environment for 20 years. They're great. But their viewpoint is very narrow, you know. Well, you get at the test sites and you've got to deliver the end product, you've got to interface with the government, you've got to take care of some of the contractual arrangements, make sure you live to those, you've got to take care of the quality arrangements, you've got to make sure that the engineering stuff is fulfilled. You just can't explain the scope. I know I wouldn't trade it for the world. And a lot of fellas came, not a lot, but the people we came out of here had some extent narrow experiences, and they come back here and they can do 5 times the job than when they left. They're just a much more valuable employee. It's kind of hard explaining that to a guy at the front end, though.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Then after you left Mississippi, you came back to Seal Beach,
mm-hmm.
and you worked for Zell?
Well, actually, when I came back, Hal Raycon was chief engineer, mm-hmm. and Ezell was the assistant chief engineer, so I reported to both of those. Mm-hmm. And I worked in, like I said, the mechanical area.
What's that entail, briefly?
Well, the way we're structured is mechanical, electrical, and structural. Mm-hmm. The mechanical group is responsible for all the analysis of the mechanical systems on the stage, so that would involve all the propulsion systems, the pressurization system, the engine, gimbaling systems, hydraulic systems, so the analytical design of those and any changes to them. Then they're also responsible for the hardware, all the components, mm-hmm. the physical design of the installation of the components, the piping, the ducting, and then all the mechanical GSC. And then while I was here, we combined some groups and we moved the flight technology group within the mechanical area just for span of management, can mm-hmm. reduce some of the management people. And that's all the trajectory, stability and control work, and that kind of stuff. And we also moved in the remaining areas we had in the system engineering organization. So that was kind of the span that I had while I was over there.
No, with mechanical, the system engineers got in with you?
Again, it was just an effort as we were compressing mm-hmm. to reduce management and the span of control of the chief engineer and, put in, in a management challenge for each of the guys. So move both of those elements in. And I guess I had that maybe for 6 months or so before I came over here.
Now, and this was back in
68.
And it was already noticeably contracting by then?
Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. I can't recall, but I call one of the first things I did as soon as I came back is I had to lay some people off. So, yeah, we were starting on the way down. Mm-hmm. Starting is the wrong word. They were in the middle of the way down, I guess.
65 was the high point.
I was going to say I thought we peaked in 66 back here.
No, December 65.
Okay, and then came down. Actually, at the test site where I'd come off, we hadn't started to come down yet because it was a little further downstream. Mm-hmm. But the engineering department, the basic design was out, and we were supporting changes and that kind of stuff, so we were coming down.
Okay, now, the engineering section is organized electrical, mechanical, and structural.
Mm-hmm.
How do you report to the program manager? Through the chief engineer?
Oh, yes. We have an engineering department responsible for all the engineering functions
mm-hmm.
and report to the program manager, just like the test organization reports, the manufacturing, the quality control, and the business side of the house.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the elements that he would have reported to him. So, also within engineering is the three prime line functions, and there's a reliability organization,
mm-hmm.
a project organization, and a little bit of a planning operation, depending on the size of the thing, you need somebody to keep track of the books.
Mm-hmm.
So those are essentially the elements. And the engineering organization has been structured this way for quite a while at North American now. We've changed a couple times during the program, but this basic structure is held. Seems to be a pretty good way to do business for, probably 4 or 5 years now.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting how you report to the functional heads other than the program manager? Do you report to...
Yes. We've got a matrix technique now that we use at the division. It's actually pretty recent as far as the S2 program, about last September. But I report to Raycon as the head of engineering and to Bill Dean as the program manager.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, it was Riker in engineering and Raycon as the program manager. In the contracting environment now, it seems like there's an advantage to getting all the engineers reporting to one guy, and then Raycon can try and keep the proper skill mix in the division by blending different
mm-hmm.
programs. We're no longer just the two program outfit with Apollo and CSM. Some of the other programs are becoming more significant, such as Shuttle, and like a year ago, Space Station was reasonably significant, the
mm-hmm.
MBM program. So there are other programs, and it seems to give a little ability to shift or keep track of skills. And Hal, worries about that kind of thing. Bill Dean worries about getting the program milestones done.
Your solid line is to Raycon, right? There is one?
Yes.
Are you having any trouble keeping your skill mix? Do you actually try to keep people here that can do certain things even though you don't have things to do for them right now?
There is a problem keeping a skill mix. I don't keep anybody that I don't have anything to do for.
Mm-hmm.
I search pretty hard for tasks or wherever mm-hmm. I can find them if I think a skill is necessary. It's a very difficult thing to keep the right skills because the skill mix tends to change as the program changes.
Mm-hmm.
That tends to change that you require to do the job. So like how many designers do we need today? Very few.
Mm-hmm.
But at the front end of a new program, you need many, many. So what you want to try and do is keep enough of the designers so you got a cadre at least that can comprehend the new problem and at least administer, direct, or supervise, if you had to bring in some new design people.
Now, do these people become so specialized they can't go from one department to another from their engineering training? Can't they take?
Well, what kind of departments are you talking about?
Any department.
The industry.
Did you major in aeronautical engineering?
Mechanical engineering, actually. It's not as easy as it theoretically sounds,
mm-hmm.
and probably to some extent not done as much as somebody from the outside would think it'd be a good way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It tend to, because maybe the complexity of the job, become specialized in individual areas. In fact, one of the functions you do as you compress is try and cross-train people so they're broader,
mm-hmm.
can do two jobs, and therefore maybe broader for the next job, too.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a problem on a stress man doing mechanical propulsion design or an electrical designer doing mechanical design or something like that. It's sometimes not a thing that's easy to come by, and
mm-hmm.
probably very few people can be that broad. But you even get specialized within, say, the mechanical or structural elements.
Mm-hmm.
Stress is a bad example. There's always a need for good stress people, it seems. But a good stress man, he's probably very specialized in that field. I'm not too sure how many other things he could do. But stress people, I'm not sure that there's a problem there. We always seem like there's enough analytical stress work going on someplace in the division that they seem like they're in demand. I'm not sure how many stress people. I don't have any figures for you, but I doubt very few of them ever hit the street from the guys that we've put out here recently.
Can you think of any other problems?
Yeah, I might. I think I know a little bit what you're searching for, and let me try a couple of emphasizers.
Okay.
A couple of other significant elements that I was involved in that proved rather significant from the program's point of view is the fracture mechanics aspect of the stage was a very significant item, and the whole business of how much a floor will grow and under what conditions and what pressures and can it result in something catastrophic is a science that's perhaps got quite a bit of art in it yet. It's very complex, and there's a lot of experts that disagree on it. Well, there was a lot of fracture mechanics work done on the S2 stage in the S2-3 time frame, about the time we were talking about putting the first man on the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And it was decided that the way to prove the vehicle was to proof test it under the environment, its worst environment. So we actually constructed a cryogenic proof test, where we loaded the vehicle with cryogenics and proof pressurized the stage. And this was a rather large undertaking from both the theoretical point of view, what's the problem, how should you solve it, and then actually conducting the test on the vehicle. We actually brought S2-3 back from the Cape to Mississippi, cryogenically tested it, and then sent it to the Cape for the first manned flight. So I think the whole reason for cryogenic proof and the fact that we did it and maybe even the way we did it is probably a fairly significant element that happened on this program. Westrop, again, if you're going to talk to him, mm-hmm. could explain in infinitely more detail than I'm able to on why cryogenic proof and the whys and wherefores of fracture mechanics. And I guess the other significant thing that I've been involved in is the pogo on the
mm-hmm.
on the Saturn V vehicle, and specifically on our stage. And I think perhaps what we've learned from Pogo, maybe some of the next vehicles can use. It seems like it's almost in the nature of the beast that most large boosters have at least a potential for Pogo. It existed on Thor, Atlas, Titan, S1C, S2, and even S4B to quite a lesser extent.
Mm-hmm.
But it's existed on almost every vehicle. And it's, again, a real complex item, and one that requires quite a bit of talent to work it. In fact, we've worked it on an industry-wide basis on the stages, Pogo working groups at Marshall, with all contractors participating, plus consultants. And actually, we feel we solved our significant Pogo problem on the 509 flight with the addition of an accumulator. But I think the Pogo experience on the S2 and on the whole stack has been pretty significant. And I guess also the insulation work that was done on the S2, you would have mm-hmm. to classify that as pushing the state of the art. We started out with honeycomb bonded insulation and then wound up with spray foam insulation with quite a bit better heat transfer characteristics. So I think a lot of work was done there.
Mm-hmm. Getting back to this Pogo problem, when you put the accumulator on the middle on the fifth engine,
mm-hmm.
This is just it's not necessarily a temporary fix, but it's kind of a, you know, add something on to get rid of the problem, but you don't really quite understand the problem yet, do you?
Mm-hmm.
It's just something that will eliminate the Pogo engine.
I guess you're saying if you build another, the next vehicle, would you put the tank on to start with? Turn it in?
Yeah, well, it's an add-on type of
Well, let's see if I can talk to that. I think so. We pretty much understand the frequency it occurs at mm-hmm. and why it occurs. If you talk about how the frequencies match up and couple up and result in a closed-loop oscillation that can grow and actually get to a point where it's potentially destructive,
mm-hmm.
I think we understand that pretty clearly. Closes the loop. We know the frequency and we know the result. And I think on our problem, we pretty much know the cause, and it was a change in the frequency of the line as some bubbles were forming in the line.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you ask me why did the bubbles form,
yeah,
that's getting into some real basic technology and inducer shape and. There is always a cavitation bubble.
Yeah.
There is always a cavitation bubble on the inducer, and at what point does it grow? We don't have a lot of dynamic information on pumps. You know,
mm-hmm.
we know what the HQ curves look like in a static environment, just flowing, but we don't know what they look like in a dynamic environment. So in that aspect, we do not know.
Mm-hmm.
But what the accumulator does is it takes the basic frequency of the line and shifts it to a point where it's all right.
Mm-hmm.
So would you do something like that in the future? I think the answer to that is probably yes.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not an accumulator, but a technique whereby if you could pick the key element of the system, if you could do something to it that is relatively simple, that you should do it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we've had some discussions with the Pogo Working Group and the Huntsville people on what should we do for shuttle. And one of the things that comes across real loud and clear is let's get in early, figure out the best we can, and put a fix in early.
Mm-hmm.
And fix, you know, what's the difference between a fix and basic design? You know, if you attack it from the beginning, you know, like you got to have bellows in lines because they, you know, there's a little bit of motion of everything.
Mm-hmm.
You could term that a fix. But I think things like this have got to be put in early.
Mm-hmm.
And we're discussing. Do you put an accumulator in? Do you use helium injection? Do you use an active control system? All these are aspects that are a long way from being resolved, but I feel real strong that you have to do something like that. The only problem you've got is time phasing your information such that you can get your analysis in a posture where it's got good enough information on which you can base this decision.
Mm-hmm.
And you get kind of wrapped up in the analysis, requires a little bit of test results to help beef it up and verify some points. It's not a pure analysis, it has to have empirical result. So you get yourself mishmashed that you don't want to get, that you can get too far downstream.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to allow yourself some options, and what you don't want to do is design your system so you can't put a fix in. So you got to be able to put one in. Maybe you don't put it in initially, but allow room for it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a, that's really a very hot subject right now in the industry, just how to attack that problem. The major centers are quite concerned, Houston, Langley, Marshall, are very concerned about it. Mm-hmm. And it's potentially a very big issue. Pogo on shuttle is a very, definitely a potential, you know, and you have to consider it.
Before we close, can you make one comment on the relationship between transfer of technology between MSFC and North American? Does any one organization seem to have a lead? Do you help each other, or do you pretty much work independently and they design parallel to
government to
to industry?
And this is personal opinion now, and I don't know if it's shared by a lot of people. Tend to think it's real good. Mm-hmm. You take things like Pogo, awful lot of transfer of information. Mm-hmm. Take things like the cryoproof work, an awful lot. Take things like insulation, mm-hmm. lots and lots of work. Huntsville's done some work on technologies and let some contract, mm-hmm. and then information flows back.
Are you able to use that in your operation?
Sure. Yet? It seems like, I think it's a relatively free exchange. Mm-hmm. I don't know of any time that I've ever talked to Huntsville and anybody said you can't have this. Mm-hmm. I mean, assume it wasn't classified or, you know, priority to some company, but it seems like it's a pretty good melting pot of getting information. I'm not always sure our administrative techniques of logging and mm-hmm. filing are maybe as best they could be, but as far as willingness, it's certainly there.
One of the things Mr. Webb used to talk about is the great team of government, industry, and universities in building the mm-hmm. Saturn Apollo. You ever hear anything from universities?
Yes. Unfortunately, I'm maybe not the best one. I've kind of been in the test side of the business during most of mm-hmm. the points at which we would use them. We have used Ashley from Stanford on Pogo, mm-hmm. and we've talked to a couple of people like Remenyuk at Georgia. He's at either Georgia Tech or University of Georgia on some of this bubble formation business. Mm-hmm. He's done some work on bubble formation. So we've used the universities to perhaps a limited extent, mm-hmm. in my knowledge. Mm-hmm. But earlier in the game, when we had some, more of the significant basic design things we're working on, we have a science center at North American, and we use them quite a bit, and I think they probably tap into the universities mm-hmm. too.
We had a number of consultants running that program from universities.
I'm sure we did. Like I say, because I was coming at it through the test mm-hmm. side of the house, we didn't tend to have consultants in that side of the house, and so
this
I'm probably
like
not aware of it.
This is like a science advisory committee mm-hmm. for the division.
And yet you're aware of it. You said yeah. this works. That's what yeah. I wanted to know. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I can't
tell you how many or specifically who their names were and that kind of stuff. I just don't know. I'd like to draw an analogy, if I'll let you put up for a second. But, is the aerospace way of doing business is any good? Or is it costly, cumbersome, and all that, mm-hmm. Two sides of the fence? I won't address whether it could be done cheaper for the moment. I tend to think it's got a lot of benefits in that if there's a problem, you seem to bring, the industry, seems to bring the full brunt of the total knowledge available to solve it, mm-hmm. Whether it be in the contractor's house, the government's house, or gosh knows where. And sometimes it means long, laborious, big meetings and maybe a little bit of churning for a while. But I think all the views opposing and for get aired. And I think at the point you go forward, a lot of times you kind of have the feeling, well, at least you've probably got a lot of all the diverse opinions. You compare that to maybe something like the medical profession, where a lot of times you're dealing with one guy making a decision based on his knowledge. Mm-hmm. I think we tend to make decisions that encompass all the people who might have little bits of knowledge. Mm-hmm. It that bears a little bit of how you manage that. It gets complex and all. Yeah. But I've had some experiences with the medical profession, and I've thought about it that way, and I think it's got some benefits. Mm-hmm. And the philosophy.
Thank you very much.